Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to welcome back entomologist Phil Pelletieri to talk about insects, especially those that enter our home at this time of the year. Some bugs even hitch a ride on your Christmas tree. And we'd love to have you join the conversation as we talk insects. Have you seen some strange bugs in your bird seed, maybe, or your pantry? What questions do you have for Phil? Have a picture of an insect that you'd like to identify? You could send that as well. And you send that through ideas@wpr.org, through the email, email@ideas@wpr.org. Or if you just want to call, that's easy too. Call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be back, Larry.
So what kind of insects come in with Christmas trees?
Well, the good news, nothing serious, and it really is somewhat unusual, but over the years we would see on white pine there is a very large aphid, so big that you might not even recognize it, an aphid, and its claim to fame, unfortunately, if you crush it, it leaves a stain. So this is the worst part of the story, but something you can just vacuum them up. You can spray them with soapy water if you have to. It usually only goes on for a couple days, if it goes on, and there's some years we don't see that. Couple other little gnat-like critters sometimes come out of some trees, balsam fir in particular. Again, a mere nuisance, nothing to worry about. And the one I remember historically that was a rumor that was not true is that deer ticks overwintered on Christmas trees, and that's not the kind of habitat they look for. And I don't ever remember officially verifying a deer tick coming on a Christmas tree. So you got to be a little careful sometimes of what people are claiming and what the reality is.
Yeah. So if you find bugs on your tree, is there, a little soapy water, I suppose, or just not, don't even bother. They're fun for the cats.
Yeah, I think the only thing is don't get too crazy, because I said the one in particular leaves kind of a purplish stain if it's crushed. And so, as I said, just kind of gently pick it up, or as I said, if you have to vacuum it, that would be probably the best remedy.
Spotted lantern flies, they're relatively new invasive pests, and I know the East Coast states are warning that lantern fly eggs might be on Christmas tree, but they say it's not likely. Should we be concerned at all about the spotted lantern fly?
Well, it's a matter of time before we see it. In fact, I talked to PJ yesterday a little bit about this, and I mean, the good news is we're located far enough north that the model suggests that it's not going to thrive, although the southeast part of the state makes us a little nervous. It's kind of, in some sense, a giant aphid. It leaves a lot of honeydew when it feeds on things. It bothers some fruit trees and the like. And so, as I said, I they do nursery inspection. This is why you certify stuff that comes from one state to the other. But as we know, some things do slip through that. And so I think eventually it's going to hit here when, you know, it's hard to predict. But as I said, when you look at the models, it's going to be more problematic in Illinois just because it's just warm enough that they have a better chance of thriving there.
Let's take a call. Cheryl in Merrimack, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. How do fruit flies get in my house, and how do I get rid of them?
Okay. a real common frustration. So there are a number of native species of fruit flies, and the question is, a lot of times we bring them in on garden produce and the like, although they can just come flying in. And what's deceptive is you see the fruit flies, you know, around the banana bowl, and you think that that's where they're breeding, and it's not. Fruit flies, their larval stage, the maggots, feed on decaying vegetable matter that has a lot of yeast associated with it. So we're talking about things that are really overly ripe and decaying. I've also seen them in recycling jars and cans if they're not rinsed properly, because, again, that stuff starts to ferment that's in there, and that could support them. So you got to be a detective. You can spray and kill the adults, but that's not the source. You have to kind of hunt it down. And one of the other common names that entomologists would give these are vinegar flies. And what that helps is when things are overly ripe, they have that kind of vinegary acetic acid smell. And that is often my nose gives it away type of thing. You got to check your garbage cans, make sure there's not a leak in there, that there isn't something caking on the bottom. It's those kind of sites that you got to hunt down.
Cheryl, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or send an email and even a photo to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Bird food. Let's talk about that for a minute. What types of bugs usually end up in bird food, bird seed?
There is a long list of critters that we identify as stored product insects that feed on all kinds of dry goods. And I will say the bird food industry has gone to great extremes in the last 20 years to prevent this. But anything from seeds to cracked corn or the like is just a perfect habitat. And these critters are found everywhere. They're dear to my heart because my master's dissertation was on stored product insects. It turns out that, you know, because pet food wasn't watched quite as close as people food, that was a little bit more commonly to have it infested. But once these critters get going, and some of them are moths, most of them are beetles, they have the capacity then to invade your cupboard and attack things like rice and other kinds of dry goods, spices, dried leaves, those kind of things they get into, and the pet food. Now, if you store your pet food outside in a sealed container, and, of course, the cool temperatures prevent a whole lot from happening, there's no problem with the birds eating anything that's infested. In fact, it probably increases their protein content in their diet. But it is good to keep those kind of items in tight enough containers that if critters are in there, they can't get out, or vice versa. If there's critters wandering around, they can't find it and start a problem.
Yeah. I've got my cat food in a sealed container that I keep that way. Carol in Johnson Creek, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Okay. I just had painted some outside trim with a light color, light gray. And in the fall, about a month ago, these black, maybe half-inch long, very narrow bugs showed up. They have a red spot on them, and they leave red stain on the trim boards. And I didn't kill them or squish them or anything, but they gathered kind of in the sunshine.
Okay. My guess, it's box elder bugs, because they're black and have this orangish-reddish marking on the back. And they do cluster in the fall on sunny locations. And this is one of those what we define as fall invaders, critters that try to get in your house. And if the house is sealed tight enough, they can't do that. And those waste spots, they do have a liquid waste. I could see where it would stain a little bit. Next spring it might be worth, if it hasn't weathered off, just to wash that off so it doesn't leave a little bit more permanent stain. It probably won't, but just as a caution. I was a little nervous about box elder bugs just because I tend to see the biggest problems in falls after dry weather, and we had a relatively dry fall in most of the state. I will tell you that it didn't get as bad as I was expecting, but I'm not surprised to hear some complaints about them.
Yeah. And there's not much you can do. I guess there are some chemicals that you could apply in the time.
When you see the congregation, if you've got an older home that's leaky, you kill them before they get in. And you can spray them with soapy water or insecticidal soap or a bunch of things, normal garden insecticides. The problem this late is if they have got in, they're in your walls or in your attic. You can't get to them. And the ones that do wake up all winter long, it's best just to clean them up because spraying is not going to solve the issue. So
yeah, there we go. Carol, thank you. Jeff in Superior, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. A couple weeks ago, I was on vacation in Kentucky driving through the beautiful countryside, and I saw these trees, and around these trees were all these hedge apples, these kind of a green, textured, size of a softball fruit or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mentioned it to some people. They said that they use them to repel insects in your closet. You can collect them and take them home and put them in your basement, and they repel insects. Is that true?
It's a partial truth. If you extract hedge apples and get the oils out of them, there is some repellency in it. But the problem is just a intact hedge apple sitting somewhere. It doesn't. In fact, I remember the original comments I heard is that they were a spider repellent. Same thing, is if you take the chemicals and chemically extract them and expose the spider to it, they're not happy. But that's what has to happen. So, there are definitely better alternatives For keeping critters out than hedge apples. And as I said, I don't know if I'd call it an urban legend, but there just doesn't seem to, there's only a little bit of science, and it doesn't support that intact apples do much good.
All right, there we go. Thanks so much for that question. How about John in Mount Horeb? What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you very much. I have a question about deer ticks. If I'm working in the woods, do I need to be concerned about deer ticks? You know, after we've had a few hard freezes, are they killed off, or they go into dormancy, or is there still a danger of Lyme disease from deer ticks?
Dormancy, but it's all about temperature. I remember seeing deer ticks come in the lab in January, or in a 60-degree day when the south sides of, where the snow had melted off. And so that's the kind of giveaway is, they really can't function below about 40, 45 degrees. So when there's snow on the ground, there's not a problem. But if the conditions change, you got to be careful. You don't get overrun with them in January when it's 60 degrees, but they're still capable. So that's what I kind of always suggested to folks is that technically there is a life stage out there that can come after you anytime there's no snow on the ground. Again, temperatures are below 45 degrees. You're probably good. Anything above that. Do keep your guard up. It depends how the winter goes, but I would still be concerned.
So as we look at the temperatures across the state of Wisconsin for the coming weekend, which is the opening of the deer season, I think the temperatures are pretty much across the state below 40 degrees. I know in Bayfield there are a high of 19 predicted for Saturday, so probably not a tick.
Yeah, no, and the other thing is if you're lucky enough to harvest a deer, not all ticks that come off of deer at this time of the year are deer ticks. There's a couple other ones you could run. And ticks are not like mosquitoes. If a mosquito was feeding on you and then you disturb it, it could come feed on me. The whole process of tick feeding is a much more involved process, and it's not like they drop off and then come running over to chase you. If they're dropping off the deer, they're probably done. So as I said, I don't, especially deer this late, during the bow season, earlier deer, a deer could have just picked up a tick and it at least could be viable, but not this late in the game.
All right. And John, thanks again. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Linda in Madison next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I like spiders, and if I find them in my house, I generally shush them outside, which is easy to do spring, summer, fall, and recently with 70-degree weather. But now that it's gotten cold, I'm looking at moving them to the garage. How cold can they tolerate, or is it just that transition from warm to 40 degrees?
Yeah, big temperature shocks are tough on any insect or spider. But I'm not so sure that there will be that big of one. To be honest, there are a handful of spiders that do thrive indoors, some of the cellar spiders and whatnot. That's just the habitat they like. The normal outdoor spiders, if conditions were right, would be going dormant. So it is reasonable to put them out in the garage. Things will cool down. You almost would wonder if you could, fill a container and put some leaf litter and some other debris just for places to hide and kind of put them in there. Just because it'll be a little less hostile than if you just throw them in the garage. And then in the spring, you can just kind of dump it out, and hopefully they will survive. But it depends. Some of the spiders you find normally would die in the fall and winter. They overwinter as eggs, and then the new generation comes that way. So, but without being a spider expert, you don't know that. So I think that's a very reasonable approach is to just put them out in the garage again in a somewhat protected place, and let's see what happens.
Yeah. There you go, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions? If you have a photo, you could email. I think Phil has access to our emails as well and can take a look at any pictures you might have, ideas@wpr.org. That's the email address. Or call at 1-800-642-1234. Phil, I don't know if you can see the photo from Gene in Madison. saw this insect on her marigolds about 2 weeks ago.
Sure. So it looks like a bee, but it's technically a fly. In fact, we would call it a syrphid or hoverfly. Adults do this bee mimic trick, we think, so that birds and other things will keep a little distance. They like to feed on nectar, but many of the species, not all, but many of the species, their larvae are predators on aphids and other things. So these are considered very beneficial insects. The other thing is Jean had mentioned she's had problems with odoriferous house ants, which is technically a species. It's a very foul-smelling one if you crush it. People used to laugh at me, but at times I would ask if they crushed the ants and what they smell, because some smell like coconut. This one, again, smells like something that's kind of sat too long. The secret with ants is you really don't have to know what species you've got. It's helpful in saying, well, they're coming in from outside or they might be nesting inside. But the other thing is what do they want to eat? Some have a sweet tooth and only like sugars and honey type things. Other ones like more protein and fats, and some will eat both. And why it's important to decide which it is the whole thing about ants is if you can find a bait that they will accept and take it back, that will wipe the colony out. And so, you know, sometimes I would suggest to folks to go in and get a little oil, you know, cooking oil or olive oil, or maybe also some honey, put it on some wax paper, see which the ants are paying attention to. And then when you go to buy bait traps, use that as, you know, as a hint of which direction you want to go. There are some baits that go both ways, but as I said, if you can find what ant you've got and find the right bait for it, it makes life a lot better. The other giveaway is if you're not seeing ants anymore, there's a real strong suspicion they are outside ants that were coming in because it's too cold now for them to be active. The contrary to that is any ants that are seen from now until March, they're showing up pretty much are living in your walls or under your basement slab or something similar.
Let's take another call. Lupe in Iola, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to ask about flies that I get in the fall in the windows. I have a relatively new house, and in the northeast windows in the fall, I get so many flies that come through the windows and then ultimately into that room.
Sure, and they look kind of like what we would commonly call a house fly?
Yes.
Okay. So the fly isn't a house fly. It's something we call a cluster fly. And interesting critter because it breeds on earthworms. But in the fall of the year, it's one of these ones that look for shelter. And, you know, what's frustrating is new homes that are really built quite tight and energy efficient still potentially have seams and cracks that critters can come through. And it's interesting that it's only on that side of the house because normally – the side of the house that has the most sun is the one that's most problematic because that tends to draw the critters in. And so, you know, it's too late to do a whole lot about it now. Next spring, though, I would really closely look around those windows to make sure they're caulked in tight. Look for any other kind of seam because the argument is if you can figure the riddle of how they're getting into those windows, you have prevented the problem forever in the future. Whereas any kind of sprays, it's already too late to do that, and that's, you know, something you got to do every year. So as I said, it suggests there's a weakness. The one other thing to look at, and sometimes this isn't as obvious, it is possible they're coming through the side of the windows, because sometimes I've seen that as a design flaw. But, you know, you're looking for a small crack or seam that something can squeeze through or whatnot, and if you can physically seal that, as I said, you will solve the problem. But it's something that they'll come every September and start the invasion into October. It depends kind of how the weather allows. And as I said, not a big deal. It's a nuisance, but something that I think the best solution is physical rather than chemical.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a very wide or large opening either.
No, and one of the things that we had seen, you know, quite commonly in new construction, they, you know, when they do the soffits, they just drop in, you know, whether it's fiberglass or wood or whatever. And those little seams there, you can see them when you walk by, are big enough for insects to crawl through. So even though, again, it's not an energy efficient issue, it is an opening. And so in cases where it's very frustrating, as I said, people have to go through physically in whether they put stuff-it type material in it or caulk it. But what do you usually, you know, the insects sometimes help solve the riddle. I mean, if they only come in the bathroom and you look and your bathroom vent fan is not sealed in tight to the ceiling, boy, that's a classic place where insects would try to take advantage. You know, they get in the attic, they don't bother you, but then they see the light or have the way of squeezing in, and then they show up in the bathroom.
Yeah. Lupe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Tom in Alloway, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Drew. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about bees and hornets and wasps. I'm allergic to them, and so all summer long I carry an EpiPen. And then when we get a hard freeze, I'll try to put the EpiPen aside. My wife wants me to carry it because she says I could go into someplace warm, and there could be a bee or a hornet or a wasp still alive flying around in some big building, a big box store or something, and I could get stung.
Probably not. So, you know, the bees and bumblebees and honeybees are all done. You don't worry about those. Where you run into just a little bit of a possibility is the way that hornets and wasps overwinter is the queens that were produced in the fall usually crawl under a rock or something and spend the winter, and then the next spring they start everything from scratch. So, again, if insects have access to an attic, can they get up in that space? Yes. In rare circumstances, if things get, you know, warm enough, they can fall down and be active. But it's very low numbers. And, again, I don't worry about big box stores. I worry more about your own house. And, yeah, as I said, you know, if you didn't have problems with wasps in the overhangs or wasps going into your walls, the chances are extremely small. And we're getting late enough now. What really happens to the other ones that are out there is they starve to death. I mean, it gets too cold for them to go get food and whatnot, and those populations have crashed now, especially with this kind of weather coming through. There's no way they would hang on. So, as I said, in this climate, nothing to worry about.
Tom, there you go. Thank you for calling. Dennis in Afton, Minnesota, will go to you next. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thanks, everybody. Yeah, sure. I think what I've got a small moth about less than a half inch, and it's kind of shaped like a pointed paper airplane. And I think that's the situation that it seems to, if I buy grains and so forth in a plastic bag, it seems like if I want to store them long term, it seems to chew right through that bag and lay eggs and all that good stuff. And so I started putting them into jars, but I'm wondering if that would even prevent it because it might be in the grain when I buy the product. And finally, I dry food, so I'm wondering, like various greens, oregano and so forth, I'm wondering long term storage. If it'll be a problem.
Okay.
Sure. So, you know, all that stuff is potential food. If I had to guess the critter that's bothering you, it's called an Indian meal moth. And this, again, goes back to that point of putting things in containers that if you were unfortunate enough to buy something that was infested, at least you see keep it contained to that and it doesn't get elsewhere. Because they are quite adept. If you know it's not a good substantial package, they can lay their eggs on the outside. The very small caterpillars can crawl through the seams, and that's how they infest boxes of cereal and other things that we have in the cupboards at times. And so, again, with your oregano and stuff, I think when you normally get it all dry and whatnot, just make sure your containers are screw-top jars or something that are substantial. I would expect them to be clean when you put them away, and you're just protecting them from other stuff. And, you know, the one thing is if you do find something that is you brought from the store, keep that in mind, I guess, to either not buy the same product or, again, you can store a lot of the stuff out in the garage. And aside from a good container, the temperatures there will be so cold that things can't breed. The problem indoors is these things go through a generation about every 4 or 5 weeks. And so if they're kept in a warm place, you give them more opportunity for their populations to explode.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Doug in Beaver Dam, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, thanks for having me. I deal with a lot of homes, and a customer of ours said they had a problem with storage lice. And I just would, if you can tell me if that's an actual thing that happens.
Sure. So if somebody gave me that name, my first inclination is something that we call book lice, or sosids are the fancy name. And although they look like a louse, they're different. But the big giveaway is those critters feed on mold. So they need very humid conditions, enough so that mold grows somewhere, and they feed on that, and then they can thrive. So a lot of times if you've got a problem in a place, it's all about better air circulation and drying things out. And that will solve the problem, because typically they can't exist in humidities below 80% for an extended period of time. And so, as I said, there's got to be some place that's too wet or too stagnant, and that's the direction I'd go after them. As I said, sometimes just simple as putting a fan in a corner of a basement will change things enough. Other times you have to do a little bit more of a physical remedy to deal with again, the moisture problems.
Doug, thank you again for calling. Mike in Minocqua, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. I thought with the holiday seasons coming up and people traveling and staying in hotels, it might be helpful to talk about bed bugs. It's pretty hard to find a hotel that isn't listed on the bed bug registry as having had an infestation at some point in time. And it's hard to deal with them and prevent them from coming home with you. And once you get them in your house, it sounds like they're almost indestructible. So.
Yeah, real frustrating, basically because of insecticide resistance and, you know, the treatments, heat treatment. I even have a relative, honestly, down in Florida that is going to have their house fumigated at a very expensive price because of their wrestling with it. Now, to be honest, I think they haven't exhausted the other possibilities. But so bed bugs will traditionally be around the bed frame and the like. And when I go into a hotel room, the giveaway for bed bugs, if you are used to looking for them, is they leave little dark spots. So I look on any kind of wood structure, the bed frame, the picture frame and whatnot, to see if I see any of that. But as far as personal protection and the like, here's a case. It might sound a little silly, but you might consider storing your suitcase in the bathtub. That's not a place you expect to find bed bugs. The problem is if you put the suitcase next to the bed where they might be living in the frame and the like, there's a chance at night they can come crawling out and crawling into your suitcase and you bring them with you. So that is, to me, one of the things I consider. Just because a place had bed bugs doesn't suggest, you know, again, they have been so widespread. I have seen in the hotel and motel industry, both educating their staff on what to look for, being sensitive to people that you know, express that they had problems. So they're much more aggressive. In fact, you know, they're using bed bug sniffing dogs and other things to jump on these problems, more so than they did when we were all kind of caught off guard, because we had not, you know, back in the 1990s, I never talked bed bugs type of thing. And it just started to blossom just a little after 2000, when we started to see the problem growing. And so, you know, it's one of those things, just kind of be aware when you go in. And you know, in the argument, it doesn't matter how much you pay. It doesn't matter how nice this thing, the hotel seems. That's got nothing to do with who's got bed bugs or not. It's more of who was in the room before you and did they potentially bring it in. And then more importantly, was it not caught early in the game and so that the population got high enough that it starts to become problematic? Mm. And so, yeah, it's good to keep your guard up and just think about, again, any items that you keep close stored to the bed or other stuff, furniture, is where I would be the most concerned, because that tends to be the kind of habitat that bed bugs like to spend the day in.
There you go, Mike. Thank you again for calling. Let's go to Bob in Tomahawk next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I've been listening to you guys for a lot of years. Thank you for such a informative and practical show. My question is, you were talking about ants before, and we bought a lake house that had carpenter ants. We had an exterminator come out. He told us that that's what the ants were. They sprayed. That took care of the problem. It was fairly expensive. And my question is, when Phil was talking about the different baits, if you know what ants you have, are there baits out there that will work for carpenter ants if we would get them back again, or do we have to go back to the exterminator?
Yeah, well, you've got a couple options. Carpenter ants are somewhat problematic, and they don't bait very well, and it's also a seasonal thing. They bait better in the spring than they do the fall. The other problem always that we run into is the problem that you were seeing ants that were living in a tree on your property and coming in to invade and basically being a nuisance, or was there evidence that they were indoors? And one of the other things that has changed is there are some sprays now that honestly last a very long period of time. And honestly, they're not sprayed indoors. They're sprayed outside along the foundation. And one treatment of these sprays would take care of carpenter ants for at least a year. Honestly, I had a minor problem in my house. The last time I treated was 3 years ago with the product. I haven't seen a carpenter ant since. And the problem with those products is it's not that they don't sell them to homeowners. They're not marketed to homeowners. So for the specialized ant baits in some of these other products, you have to basically order it on the internet under the Do Your Own Pest Control. They're not restricted use products in Wisconsin, meaning that you have to be licensed and certified to use them. It's just a marketing thing. And so you do have the option. And you know, if it comes to that, you can email me or email PJ, and we can make some suggestions if you want to go the chemical route. And as I said, if you prefer the baits, that's fine too. But it's best to get them in spring. That's when their food demands are highest. They're easiest to bait. When you get into you know, September, I tell people usually don't bother with that. The better way is if you knew where they were, I mean, it only takes two squirts of any ant killer to wipe out a carpenter ant colony if you know where they are. But that detective work is, you know, if the sawdust is coming out of the ceiling in your house, you know they're up there and you can get them. But just these occasional ants that are wandering in, there's very little you can do other than trying to trail them. I mean, I used to tell people that they maybe laughed at me a little bit, but it's worth sometimes putting out a food source, you know, cat food or something, out on the back stoop and go out at night with a flashlight during the summer and see, are the ants crawling out into the wilderness? And you can really trail them sometimes into where the source is, or are they crawling up and go into your soffit, which would suggest that the nest is up there. So doing detective work, if you're willing to put the time in, is well worth it.
Bob, thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Listener called, couldn't stay with us, but would like to hear your definition of an insect. And would also like to know the biggest and smallest insects that we know about.
Oh, boy. Well, even among entomologists, there is a little bit of disagreement of what officially is a true insect or something related to insects. But generally, we're talking about an animal that in the adult stage has three pairs of legs, total of six. In fact, we call them hexapods, which means six-legged creatures. One pair of antennae, three general body regions. They have a head. They have a middle section where the wings and legs are found that we call the thorax in the abdomen. So that's kind of a general thing. And again, then we get into some disagreements with spring tails and other things if they're truly insects. Biggest insect, well, it depends if you're talking wingspan or like, you know, the big Goliath and Hercules beetles out of Africa and Central America are body size the biggest things. Some of the great big silkworm moths from Southeast Asia, you know, have wingspans of upwards of 8, 10 inches. Maybe Atlas moth may be a little bit more than that. On the small side, boy, you get into a lot of critters that are a half millimeter in size, you know, little fairy flies and, again, springtails and the like. I'm sure on the internet there's some place that has the official smallest and biggest, but those are the ones that would come to mind with that in mind. And, you know, even though the science fiction movies have fun with the giant insects, the issue is the way their body is constructed. They're kind of limited to these, you know, 3-inch long, 4-inch long at best critters, because they don't really have a good circulatory system that can move things around internally. And so if they were big without a true heart per se and, you know, blood vessels like what we have with most animals that we think of, the sheer weight of the body would just collapse on their breathing tubes and everything else. So as I said, we're talking critters that still are limited no matter how good the food is and everything else to relatively small animals.
Owen in Cornucopia sent us a photo, and I hope you can see that one, Phil. It's a picture, small spider attacking a large wasp, and the persistence finally paid off as the spider was able to subdue the wasp by surrounding it with webbing.
Oh, my. Okay. So this is a very specialized wasp. This is a type of wasp that attacks horntails. Now, horntails are a sawfly-like insect that lives in dead wood. And as the name implies, the horntail itself is a big, menacing-looking creature and injects its eggs into the wood with a stinger that is, you know, maybe almost a half inch in length. Turns out this critter is a predator, or a parasite, depending how you want to define it. And it has to drill this very long stinger-looking item into the wood to lay its eggs so it grubs can feed on the horntails. They're kind of they're scary-looking critters, absolutely harmless to people.
Ignomen,
and
are
this
they
unfortunate
called?
One got into the spider web, and then things went downhill.
Yeah. Ignomen, is that how it's pronounced for the wasp?
It is a type of ichneumonid wasp, but this is a special subgroup, as I said, that is associated with wood-boring insects.
Okay. He says when he sees that in an area, a particular area of his yard with lupins covered with aphids, he just sprays them with Raid and they fall off and the lupin survives. Is there any danger to this practice that he may be unaware of?
Well, you know, two things. You got to make sure the Raid is labeled for doing plant material. There's some Raid products that are only used a label for household, and the difference isn't so much the chemical, but the carriers, and sometimes there are oils and other things in the household version that would burn plants. The other argument is that if there is some residual to the chemical, it will potentially kill beneficial insects because it will last for 4 or 5 days, and so it has. And so aphids, it's interesting. Now, lupin, when aphids really get going, you got to do something to understand it, but most aphids will go through multiple generations a year, and the only reason that we are not overrun with them is because the beneficial insects will catch up. It's a guarantee, whether it's lady beetles or hoverflies, or there's a whole litany of good critters there. So, you know, usually when I'm out in the garden and I'm looking and I see some aphids, that's the first thing I'm looking for is you know, does it appear the populations are going up? But more importantly, is there signs of beneficial insects being active? If so, I probably let them do their thing. Or if I am forced to use something, it's sometimes best to use something with short residual. And that's why we like insecticidal soap, because it only kills what you spray. And to be honest, hard-bodied insects like ladybird beetles and what aren't affected by the soap because it doesn't penetrate through their skin. So it's a somewhat selective insecticide.
Beth in Grafton has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad to talk to you. We have sewer flies in our apartment, and we've been there, it'll be 4 years in June, and we've had them since we moved in. They've had a person come and, I think, twice spray some foam down the drains. It helps for a little while, and then they come back. We've done everything from boiling water every night to everything now we just keep the drains shut when we can, but we still have them. And I need some expert advice on what to tell the management on how to get rid of these things.
So does it seem to be like a basement floor drain that's the problem, or is it the bathroom sink types of things, or?
It's definitely in the master bathroom, but when I tell the management that, they say, well, they fly all over, you know, they could be coming from anywhere, which is true, but we mostly see them in the master bathroom shower drain, sink drain, and then, of course, they go to the window of the bedroom and die there, and yep. We've seen them in every room of the apartment. I'm just so done with them.
Yeah, they are frustrating, and it's another one of these things. You got to get lucky enough to hunt the right spot down. Now, you know, I'm hoping that the product that they put down, the foaming agent, is kind of a degreaser and whatnot, because what it is that gunk that coats around the pipes and the drains is where the maggots are found. So, you know, I mean, some people would put bleach down there. That didn't do anything other than sterilize the outside. I mean, we sterilize insects with bleach when we're doing experiments. So it's better to get, in some cases, they even use in industrial settings where they have a lot of organic matter that accumulates in drains. They use biological degraders, you know, where products will literally eat through that sludge. And the question is where exactly is this sludge accumulating? And, you know, I think they gave it a good shot initially, but it isn't, you know, to keep coming back and doing the same thing, I don't expect the results to change. Some of the places that, you know, I poke around in is aside from the drains in my bathroom sink and the like, is the overflow cut. You know, most of our sinks have a hole in there so that if the water gets too high, rather than spilling out, it will go in. Well, that gets kind of cruddy in there, too, and at times. And so, again, that's another place that you would look to try to clean out as best you can. Does it seem to get better at all when we get to this time of the year, or is it just constant?
No, I was hoping it would. And then, you know, we'll go a couple days without seeing any, and then the next morning we'll have three in our bathroom. It's like...
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so again, this is just kind of an experiment, but it may be worth just using a little bit of tape on your overflow cuts on your bathroom sink, and you know, keep the drain shut. And for your shower drain or whatnot, again, I would even consider just putting a little Saran wrap or, you know, something to seal, so that anything that's coming up from the bottom can't get into your living space, and at least you can see it, to try to give you more of a hint of what needs to be attacked a little bit more aggressively, as far as, they said, finding that gumpy organic matter and getting it flushed out. It has to have moisture because, you know, just dry organic matter doesn't support sewer flies and drain flies. They need moisture and a good rich source of organic matter, which, you know, we all have problems with stuff caking in our drains. But as I said, I'm just wondering, the next step would be is a set of having something that might be a little bit different than the initial product they used to clean through it. Because, you know, what I'm worrying about is whatever they're using isn't eating through the organic matter sufficiently enough to flush and have a clean pipe system, and that's allowing the drain flies to continue to breed. And your numbers are high enough that, you know, that's not normal. I mean, we get four or five around the house a year, and my wife, of course, teases me a little bit about not being a good entomologist, but usually I can, you know, kind of clean things up, and it's good to clean those drains every once in a while anyway with a brush or the like. That's what I usually do, and that takes care of it.
Beth, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the insects that may be invading your house, inside or out of it, with our guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. We'll go back to the phones, and Ken in Mayville has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ken.
I had a great experience a number of years ago. Unfortunately, it was pre-cell phone or pre-smartphone, so I would have loved to have videotaped it. But I was sitting at a art fair. My wife is an artist, and we were sitting in the booth, and I'm looking up, and there's this beautiful dragonfly flying around, huge dragonfly, and out of nowhere, a yellow jacket came down, nailed the dragonfly. It fell down into a box, like, right in front of me. The yellow jacket cut the wings off, cut the feet off, tried to fly off with it, couldn't fly off with it, turned around, cut the head off, and then took off and took off with the rest of it.
Oh, my goodness.
that would have been one heck of a video. I think you would have got lots of people just amazed at the capacity. I'm even guessing that was probably a bald-faced hornet, because we're talking something substantially enough to wrestle with a dragonfly, because there are times I can expect dragonflies to feed on yellow jackets with how they go. So it doesn't sound like a fair fight, but it might have potentially been if the yellow jack or the dragonfly knew it was coming.
Oh, man. There you go. Ken, thanks for sharing that. Man, what an experience. And probably one you'll never get again, Ken. Colette in Eagle River. Hi. Thanks for calling.
I have a really weird experience like that, too, but I'm looking maybe for more information. I was digging in my garden in River Falls, Wisconsin, I think doing some transplants, you know, close to the ground. And there was, I saw this huge black shiny ground beetle, but it was covered with little tiny beetles crawling all over it. It seemed really healthy, but I believe they were brown. They could have been black but I'm sure they were just crawling all over this little tiny thing, covering it. Could that be some form of reproduction, or would that be like a parasitic sort of thing?
Yeah, parasitic. I think they're mites. You do find mites. The one beetle family that is notorious for having mites crawling around are the sylphids or carrion beetles, which could be crawling around the ground. You do see them occasionally on some of the longhorn wood boring beetles too, but they are dark brownish, some almost reddish, and they don't seem to be an overly aggressive parasite in the sense that they hurt the prey. In fact, one of the discussions with a lot of cases is they're not so much preying on the beetle, but they're using the beetle as a way of dispersing to where they want to go next. And in the case of carrion beetles, a lot of those mites are more predators on maggots and the like. So they need to find a dead animal, and that's where a carrion beetle is going to fly to. So they're kind of hitchhiking is probably the best way of putting it. So that would be my first guess, is it could be a carrion beetle, and the mites are kind of hitching a ride more so than being a parasite on the beetle itself.
Yeah, very interesting. Colette, thank you very much for that call. Bert in Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Bert.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, sporadically on my land in central Wisconsin, I'll get these big swarms of fleas on the grounds,
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just really curious as to what they are. This last fall, they actually swarmed around the house a lot, but that was the first time I had them close to the house. So I've never seen any problems from it, but just really curious as to what they are and what they do.
Yeah, so I think you've got springtails. And one of the common names for springtails are snow fleas because they do jump, and there are times that you can see them in March and the like when there's still snow on the ground. They live in the soil. They feed on organic matter. They're harmless. They can't bite. They can't sting. But you do get certain cases where the populations are just explode. In fact, it's interesting. I got a picture by email that was sent in for me to identify, and the person said pantry beetles. They were wondering if the critters were you know, associated with their stored food, and it turns out the pantry beetles are springtails. And they're not seeing them now because it's too cold. And my advice to that person is it's one of two things. Either you've got a leak in the wall and there's enough mold and mildew that the springtails are breeding there, or more likely they came in from outside by accident, and coming indoors is often a dead end. It's too dry. There's nothing to eat. But as I said, the phenomena is such is when they really get rolling, and we have had major nuisance problems sometimes when people build houses in marshes where they've got this rich organic matter soil that there's just millions of springtails along the foundation, and then again, they kind of spill in the house and create a nuisance, but they definitely don't hurt anything. So interesting critter, and again, you might even look up snow fleas. They'll tell you about what's happening with those ones that come out in March and the like, and it's an so.
Yeah, there you go, Bert. Thank you very much for calling. Switching over to emails for a minute here, Sarah emailed a photo of a plant, a hibiscus plant. They've been bringing this hibiscus in and out of the house for the last few years, and this is the first time they've seen these insects attacking the buds.
Yeah, they've got aphids, a big-time aphids. And, you know, if you look at the picture real closely, some of the pictures, there's little white things which are really cast skins. You know, aphids molt their skin just like other insects grow. So, and usually what I look for is if there's more little white things than green things, it often suggests the population's going down. But these numbers are high enough, they're going to start finding sticky stuff coming off on the leaves and maybe underneath it. It'd be well worth spraying one spray of insecticidal soap. Just knock them down. Might be a little bit of a bother if the plant's big. They might have to put it in the bathtub to spray it. But if they don't, because of the conditions indoors, they will continue to breed. And, you know, the argument indoors, there's no predators. It's a perfect environment for insect populations to explode. And systemic insecticides, which you can put in the soil, although they help slow things down, they usually don't solve the problem because systemics often don't go into the flowers very efficiently. And that's where these aphids are thriving. So, as I said, I think just an insecticidal soap spray to knock the population down should take care of it.
Steve in Boulder Junction, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. One time earlier this summer, in the morning when there was dew on the grass and there were spider webs all over on top of the grass on at least an acre of lawn.
Yeah. What could have made that?
Well, you know, one of my neighbors who spends quite some time in Bayfield sent me a picture kind of exactly as you described. And there are different kinds of spiders. There are sheet web spiders, and there are ground spiders, and sometimes without having a real good look at it. But it gives you an idea of how many spiders are really out there, and you don't witness it until you get that dew kind of condition, which highlights the webs and catches your attention. And as I said, sometimes it makes great photographic subjects, and it is somewhat mind-boggling at times how many spiders really are out there, but I'm sure that's what was going on. And it's interesting, again, because I said my neighbor showed me a picture from the northern part of the state that exactly fits what you witnessed.
Oh, there you go, Steve. So they're out there. We just don't often see them. That's the way it works. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Phil Pelletieri, our guest entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He'll be with us right up until 12:30. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about insects on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Phil Pelletieri, former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's an entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Questions for him, the number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email and possibly a photo to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones. Jim in Dodge County, thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry and Phil. We had resolved the carpenter ant horror story several years ago. We had a kitchen dining area addition added to the house, and the house is on the edge of a woods. And indeed, the addition was on the north side of the house in the woods. And unfortunately, there was to be a deck above it, so it was a flat roof with a membrane coating on it, and it was the floor joists, ceiling joists weren't vented properly, and so the particle board, the floor of the deck itself, rotted, and the carpenter ants found it, and we didn't know that it happened until we started seeing 5 or 10 carpenter ants per day in that dining area, and so I got poison traps or whatever, and I set them around on the floor and on the window sills. And as soon as the nest found that, they were attracted to it, and it turned into a horror story. They just started crawling down the walls on all three sides, and it would be 100 or 150 at a time coming down the walls.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are staggering in colonies that are 3 or 4 years old. The good part of that is everything you see are sterile females. And so, you know, the thing is, generally carpenter ants have one queen, and that's why the argument always is if you get lucky enough to find, and whether you bait it and she gets fed the poison or you spray into the nest and kill her, that's what solves the issue. But if you don't know where the nest is, you can kill all those workers and she just keeps producing more. And, you know, colonies can easily go 8-10 years. And they do produce what are called satellites. Sometimes when the space gets confining, they will send out groups and raise young elsewhere, but then they all move back to the main nest in the fall. And so sometimes, you know, when I get a call of a brand new house that has carpenter ants, it doesn't make sense because there's no wood that's rotted enough or decayed enough to support them, but it could be a satellite colony that has to be dealt with. It can be extremely dramatic because, as I said, the numbers are. And the crazy thing is that carpenter ants are found everywhere. Their presence doesn't scare me. They're not termites. They don't eat wood, but they nest in wood that is often compromised, and often they get blamed for that. They're really not the culprit in most cases. So.
Yeah, Jim, quite the story. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Appreciate it. Katie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question about springtails. The first being, if you have a kind of summertime invasion and they go away in the winter, are you always expecting them to come back? Is there any way to really eradicate them? And then the second part is, like you mentioned, they don't really create any harm to the house or to people. Do they have to be disclosed as an infestation in Wisconsin Realtor reports?
Not that I'm aware of. That's usually carpenter ants, termites, and powder post beetles that are the three insects, I think, that are official. It depends. Sometimes you get an explosion and you don't see it again for 20 years. On the other hand, again, if you've got very rich organic matter soil, there could be lots of springtails there all the time, and so it's kind of an annual occurrence. You know, there I would look very carefully where your siding meets the foundation, that everything is sealed as tight as can be, stuffed or whatever, so that they can't spill into the house. That would help. In extreme cases, sometimes people will spray along the foundation out maybe 4 to 5 feet to try to knock the populations down. If that is the breeding source, that may reduce it a lot. But sometimes I see springtails just keep kind of migrating in from much greater distances. And so it depends on the situation. And in the worst case, where they are just thriving everywhere in your yard, it may be, unfortunately, a bit of an annual nuisance. And then I go back to, as I said, if you can solve the riddle of how they're spilling in and just get things tightened up so they behave themselves outside, things will be much, much better. Reduce the amount of organic matter along the foundation would help. Here's a case where organic mulches, which are good for the plants, also provide the kind of habitat that makes springtails happy.
Katie, thanks very much for calling. Barry in Madison, what's on your mind?
Yes, I wanted to follow up with the woman who called in about the sewer flies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Depending on what the infrastructure is like, would you consider sulfuric acid or a diluted sulfuric acid, particularly, it can be unsafe if you don't know what you're doing, but...
I go back to my experiences in big major food handling places, which have all kinds of options in what they've had to go to, because I'm not sure the sulfuric acid will do more than, again, coat the outer side of things. Is they have these biological digester products that have various organisms that thrown in there will eat through that sludge, which will eventually allow it to flush and the like. And so, as I said, that both label-wise would be probably better and safer to work with. I have seen crazy cases where it's vents from toilets and other things that some reason got caking organic matter in. As I said, so sometimes being a good enough detective of finding where the source is, but in most homes, basement floor drains are notorious because you don't get enough water to flush to really clean them in most cases. And even, again, most of our showers eventually between hair clogging and whatnot get a kind of a buildup. And so, aside from running something through that physically to try to dislodge and move any kind of things that's plugging, dropping this digestive-type material that takes, in some cases, 2 or 3 weeks to eat through what they need to eat through. But as I said, eventually that seems to be the direction to go.
Barry, thanks very much for calling. Mary Kay in Cuba City, on to you now. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. I am wondering what impacts the population of box elder bug invasions on our house every fall, and if cutting down box elder trees has any impact on reducing those.
It will if you get the major sources. There are some communities that do not allow box elder to be planted as a tree on the terrace because of the occasional bad years where there's so many box elders. The trouble is if you live in a 5-acre woodlot and there's lots of box elders, I mean, your problem can come from 100 yards away. But if you've got only one big box elder tree and it's not an important shade tree and you removed it, they only breed on box elder. Once in a great while, they'll try maple. You know, box elder is technically a type of maple, but they're primarily a seed-feeding insect that goes through 2 generations on box elder. In normal years, a lot of them get a fungus disease and die, but in dry years, the fungus disease doesn't work, and that's when we get these population explosions.
Yeah. Mary Kay, thank you for calling. Tim in Milsonville, on to you now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a small woodlot. I have a portable bandsaw sawmill. and I cut a lot of poplar in particular, other species also, but I end up with powder post beetles in the lumber.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing they are powder post beetles because that's what they look like, or it looks like. I found one time in my workshop when I was working, and it was kind of an iridescent green color.
Okay, So when you cut wood in the first couple years, there is a whole long list of longhorn wood boring beetles. The one you've got might be a metallic wood borer and various other families. But they're a one-way street. They might take a couple, 3 years to come out, but then they're done, so they do not reinfest the wood. Powder post beetles honestly look very similar to the insects you get in cereal. They're dark brownish insects, maybe a little bit longer and a little bit skinnier. And they do not infest wood until it's at least 2 or 3 years post-cutting. There are both false powder post beetles and regular powder post beetles. They get both in conifers and in hardwoods. The higher starch content wood tends to have more problems, and the amount of moisture in the wood the more moisture that remains in the wood, the happier the beetles are. So, you know, people who kiln dry and whatnot, that's one of the processes. It kills the insects that are there, but it also dries the wood, not making it 100% resistant, but very much reduces the attack by powder post beetles if they're stored in a way that they don't take on more moisture and the like. And so the problem is with that wood when you're cutting it, if the beetles are in there and they're not killed, the kind of ones that come with the dead wood, you kind of have to let them run their course, or as I said, put it in a kiln and kill them by heat. Now, if you've got wood long-term storage, and I worry more about ash and walnut and oak with powder post beetles, there are various boric acid-type treatments that can be put on the wood that prevent powder post beetles from attacking them. But in your case, what I'd suggest, you get critters, send them into PJ so you can identify them properly, so you can kind of identify which direction this is coming at you from and the like. And generally, I don't worry about poplar near as much as I do as some of the hardwoods that we get into. And as I said, the critter you saw definitely was somebody else.
Yep. And again, you just go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab online, and you get all the information right there for sending to PJ. There you go, Tim. Thank you. Jim in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. In the 70s, when you would buy gas for your car, you had to clean the bugs off the windshield. Today, that doesn't happen so much anymore. And what I'm wondering about is with the reduction in insects in general, do we need to start doing something to support insects?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. There was an absolutely fascinating article, I think, in the New York Times or Washington Post within the last 3 weeks addressing this issue.
New York Times, I think it was.
Yeah, and you know, it kind of went twofold. There definitely is a lot of evidence that the insect populations are on a major decline. But they had an argument, and it had to do with how many miles people are traveling and designs of cars and everything else, to suggest it's not as bad as it looks like with the lack of insects on your windshield. And said it's worth looking up. I kind of understood what they were saying. Some of it might have been a little over my head. But now, as far as supporting it, you know, the general idea that comes to us ecologically of having more diverse habitats, the more diverse habitats we have, the more diverse plants we have, the greater variety of insects. And so it kind of all is a great big tied-in web, if you think of it that way. And so, again, you know, asphalt is not a good place for insects. To be honest, lawns aren't a good place for insects. But general, you know, woodlots with lots of plant diversity and the like are the kind of things we need. The same discussion comes agriculturally. What we do with our fields now is so much different than what we did 50 years ago, and it probably promotes less insect diversity, which is a concern because that supports birds and the like. So, you know, it definitely is a concern. But other than, you know, being a little bit more cautious sometimes with some of the chemicals we use and doing anything we can support to have a more diverse environment out there, those are the directions we need to go.
Yep, and that's why you often talk about barriers and putting up barriers to keep insects out and things of that nature.
Right.
rather than insecticide. David emailed. He asks, are the aphids that get large numbers on milkweed, do they have the same chemicals as the monarch butterfly caterpillars? Because you never see predators attacking the large numbers on milkweed.
I guess I have seen plenty of beneficial insects. It is an aphid that is exclusive to milkweed. Are they potentially holding or sequestering some of the chemicals? I'm not sure, but it wouldn't surprise me because they're feeding on the plant sap, so the chemical is there. But generally, that helps them to be distasteful to big predators, you know, birds and mice or whatever, because it, you know, it doesn't taste good. But as far as other insects, they don't respond to that. So I don't think so. I don't think it really offers them much protection against the insect predators that help control aphid populations would be my guess.
Let's take a call from Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
I just wonder, maybe Larry would remember, I don't know about his guess, but I live in La Crosse, and, of course, we're near the Mississippi, and back in the 50s and early 60s, there were a lot more insects, and the street lamps, which were old incandescent bulbs, would attract moths. But there were so many insects, dragonflies and such, that practically every third car that went up and down our street had what they call an insect screen. They'd sell them in auto parts stores. So your regular car grill wouldn't get, you know, collect a lot of unsightly bugs. But the screens themselves weren't that, you know, aesthetically pleasing.
No, they sure right? weren't.
No, I agree with you. I come from that era. I remember as a kid sitting in front of streetlights and just watching clouds of critters coming and the like. And you don't see that. And again, they've changed the type of bulbs. They're less attractive, but there just isn't the insects that we saw. And again, you know, La Crosse, you get tremendous hatches off the river at times, but tremendous now is not what tremendous was 30, 40 years ago, as far as I'm concerned. As I said, and this is not just a North American phenomena, you know, reports out of Germany, reports out of Puerto Rico, a lot of places where they've been looking at insect populations over a long period of time, we've seen dramatic and stunning declines. And as I said, those of us that are a little bit older in years definitely remember a different time when there was a lot more critters out there.
Cynthia sent us an email and photo, Phil. Cynthia's picture sent us a picture and wondering what this bug is she found in her kitchen. It's not...
So it's not... This is a case, not a true insect. The animal is called a pseudoscorpion, which is a group of animals of its own, you know. It has big pincers on it like a scorpion, but they're tiny. We're talking something that's only about, eighth of an inch or so in size. They are predators, and so they feed on various little critters in the house. Don't bite, don't cause any problems. Because indoors is not a great place to find food, you never get overrun with pseudoscorpions, mostly active at night. And unless you get one cornered, you're not even aware they're there. But if you get one cornered, they act pretty hostile. They take those pincer-like front legs and they move them back and forth to kind of scare you off, which, of course, doesn't scare anybody a whole lot. But an interesting animal. And as I said, if you look up, you can get a lot of stuff on pseudoscorpions. It's honestly one of my favorite animals. I used to enjoy when people would send me samples in the lab.
Rachel emailed us a question. Any advice? Oh, well, you just talked about powder post beetles, but she has a 115-year-old home. Wasn't lived in for 45 years, nor any heating or cooling. It's on a wooded lot on Rock County, on the Rock River in Jefferson County. And this past summer, she noticed tiny piles of sawdust and pin-sized holes throughout the maple flooring. It's mostly in the main level, but she noticed a few spots elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised that they didn't go gangbusters when the place was not heated and the like, because, again, the moisture levels in your wood are much higher. You know, one of the things that saves us from powder post beetles in this climate is we all heat our homes, dry them out so much in the winter that usually established flooring and the like gets dry to the point that powder post beetles are not successful. Now, the other thing that they need to get access to is sealed flooring. They can't get through. But if they're cracks or the holes of old powder post beetles, that is an access point. Don't panic in that I think I would get things assessed very carefully. Sometimes I've found it's only been a couple boards that are bad, and the best solution is to replace them. But the trouble here is going to be is if they continue to thrive, and maybe they won't because, again, now you're going through a heating season, you're going to dry the house out, that's going to make it hostile. It takes time. Powder post beetles can take 5, 7, even 10 years to go through a life cycle. In fact, the less moisture and the less starch in the wood, the longer it takes them to go through. So, but the problem is if you're going to have to address it, in this case, if it's problematic enough, you're going to have to strip the floor so that the treatment can soak into the wood and then refinish the floor. As I said, it's well worth kind of taking your time and assessing it carefully. And I'm cautiously optimistic that now that the house is lived in, that that's going to change the conditions over time in your favor. And as I said, the one thing that I'm a little curious about is, given the history of the house of being vacant for so long, is why didn't they thrive more under those conditions?
I mentioned at the start of the show we might talk about insect migration, like bird migration. That doesn't happen at this time of the year, though, does it, Phil?
Well, you know, other than the famous monarch, generally not. I mean, insects are great in the spring of getting in the southern air currents and blowing up here. They thrive for as long as they can, and then in the winter, it's like shutting the door. They really, for the most part, don't go back down. But the next wave's coming next spring because that's just, you know, the way they try to take advantage of the opportunity. Yeah, there's lots of stuff you can talk about, neat stuff in the spring about insects, and it has an awful lot to do with stuff blowing up here from Texas and Louisiana and the like, but not vice versa.
Gary wonders if you can use mothballs in bird seed to kill pests without hurting the birds.
Mothballs work as a fumigant. Honestly, it won't leave any residual, but I don't like to breathe any more mothballs than I have to. You know, one of the things you can do on occasion, so, you know, we talked very early in the show about the shock of temperature change that kills insects.
Yeah.
So if you take insects and warm them up and have them active, and then you throw them in the freezer for 4 or 5 days, that shock will kill them. Whereas if you leave the bird seed out in the garage and you go through the gradual cooling in the fall, they'll survive the winter, but not that big shock. So I like the physical method, or the other side, you can heat things. Any insect at 112 degrees is toast. And so sometimes you can dry things out if you have to. As I said, the mothball thing, if you put it in a closed container and left it long enough, but again, for the mothballs to volatilize, you have to keep it warmer. They don't do as much. And as I said, I think there are better methods of dealing with the critters.
Well, on that note, Phil, we are out of time. Boy, it's always a pleasure to have you come by. I really appreciate it, and look forward to your very next visit. Thanks, Phil.
Take care, Larry.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us, and he'll be back in a few months, and we will do this all over again. Always great to have him come by. Just looking ahead to tomorrow's program, we will be talking with the author of the book Once Upon a December. It's a Christmas rom-com or romantic comedy kind of thing set in Milwaukee. Jill Nadeau will be hosting the program, by the way, so I want to mention that. And she will be getting some tips on traveling alone. What do you need for advice if you plan to travel all by yourself? Well, you're going to learn all about that tomorrow at 11 on The Larry Mueller Show. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.